Even the 10 was counted. This bold player would pounce upon you from behind, unheralded, unseen, with a scream of triumph. I felt as tense and expectant as I did then. I was playing Old Witch with Mrs. Danvers. Lunch was a welcome break to the long morning. The calm efficiency of Frith and Robert's rather foolish face helped me more than my book and my newspaper had done. And at 3:30, punctual to the moment, I heard the sound of Beatrice's car round the sweep of the drive and pull up at the steps before the house. I ran out to meet her, ready dressed, my gloves in my hand. "Well, my dear, here I am. What a splendid day, isn't it?" She slammed the door of the car and came up the steps to meet me. She gave me a hard, swift kiss, brushing me somewhere near the ear. "You don't look well," she said immediately, looking me up and down. "Much too thin in the face and no colour. What's wrong with you?" "Nothing," I said humbly, knowing the fault of my face too well. "I'm not a person who ever has much colour."
"Oh, bosh," she replied. "You looked quite different when I saw you before."
"I expect the brown of Italy has worn off," I said, getting into the car.
"Humph," she said shortly. "You're as bad as Maxim. Can't stand any criticism about your health. Slam the door hard or it doesn't shut."
We started off down the drive, swerving at the corner, going rather too fast.
"You're not by any chance starting an infant, are you?"
she said, turning her hawk-brown eyes upon me. "No," I said awkwardly. "No, I don't think so."
"No morning sickness or anything like that?"
"No."
"Oh, well, of course it doesn't always follow. I never turned a hair when Roger was born. Felt as fit as a fiddle the whole 9 months. I played golf the day before he arrived. There's nothing to be embarrassed about in the facts of nature, you know. If you have any suspicions, you'd better tell me."
"No, really, Beatrice," I said. "There's nothing to tell."
"I must say I do hope you will produce a son and heir before long. It would be so terribly good for Maxim. I hope you're doing nothing to prevent it."
"Of course not," I said. What an extraordinary conversation.
"Oh, don't be shocked," she said. "You must never mind what I say. After all, brides of today are up to everything. It's a damn nuisance if you want to hunt and you land yourself with an infant your first season. Quite enough to break a marriage up if you're both keen. Wouldn't matter in your case. Babies needn't interfere with sketching. How is the sketching, by the way?"
"I'm afraid I don't seem to do much," I said.
"Oh, really? Nice weather, too, for sitting out of doors. You only need a camp stool and a box of pencils, don't you? Tell me, were you interested in those books I sent you?"
"Yes, of course," I said. "It was a lovely present, Beatrice." She looked pleased.
"Glad you liked them," she said.
The car sped along. She kept her foot permanently on the accelerator and took every corner at an acute angle. Two motorists we passed looked out of their windows, outraged as she swept by, and one pedestrian in a lane waved his stick at her. I felt rather hot for her. She did not seem to notice, though. I crouched lower in my seat.
"Roger goes up to Oxford next term," she said. "Heaven knows what he'll do with himself. Awful waste of time, I think, and so does Giles. But we couldn't think what else to do with him. Of course, he's just like Giles and myself. Thinks of nothing but horses. What on earth does this car in front think it's doing? Why don't you put out your hand, my good man? Really, some of these people on the road today ought to be shot."
We swerved into a main road, narrowly avoiding the car ahead of us.
"Had any people down to stay?" she asked.
"No, we've been very quiet," I said.
"Much better, too," she said. "Awful bore. I always think there's big parties. You won't find it alarming if you come to stay with us. Very nice lot of people all around, and we all know one another frightfully well. We dine in one another's houses and have our bridge and don't bother with outsiders. You do play bridge, don't you?"
"I'm not very good, Beatrice."
"Oh, we shan't mind that, as long as you can play. I've no patience with people who won't learn. What on earth can one do with them between tea and dinner in the winter and after dinner? One can't just sit and talk."
I wondered why. However, it was simpler not to say anything.
"It's quite amusing now Roger is a reasonable age," she went on, "because he brings his friends to stay, and we have really good fun. You ought to have been with us last Christmas. We had charades. My dear, it was the greatest fun. Giles was in his element. He adores dressing up, you know, and after a glass or two of champagne, he's the funniest thing you've ever seen. We often say he's missed his vocation and ought to have been on the stage."
I thought of Giles and his large moon face, his horn spectacles. I felt the sight of him being funny after champagne would embarrass me.
"He and another man, a great friend of ours, Dickie Marsh, dressed up as women and sang a duet. What exactly it had to do with the word in the charade, nobody knew, but it did not matter. We all roared."
I smiled politely. "Fancy. How funny," I said. I saw them all rocking from side to side in Beatrice's drawing room, all these friends who knew one another so well. Roger would look like Giles. Beatrice was laughing again at the memory.
"Poor Giles," she said. "I shall never forget his face when Dick squirted the soda siphon down his back. We were all in fits."
I had an uneasy feeling we might be asked to spend the approaching Christmas with Beatrice. Perhaps I could have influenza.
"Of course, our acting was never very ambitious," she said. "It was just a lot of fun amongst ourselves. At Mandley now, there is scope for a really fine show. I remember a pageant they had there some years ago. People from London came down to do it. Of course, that type of thing needs terrific organisation."
"Yes," I said. She was silent for a while, and drove without speaking.
"How is Maxim?" she said, after a moment.
"Very well, thanks," I said.
"Quite cheerful and happy?"
"Oh, yes. Yes, rather." A narrow village street engaged her attention. I wondered whether I should tell her about Mrs. Danvers, about the man Favell. I did not want her to make a blunder, though, and perhaps tell Maxim. "Beatrice," I said, deciding upon it, "have you ever heard of someone called Favell? Jack Favell?"
"Jack Favell," she repeated. "Yes, I do know the name. Wait a minute. Jack Favell. Oh, of course, an awful bounder. I met him once ages ago."
"He came to Mandalay yesterday to see Mrs. Danvers," I said.
"Really? Oh, well, perhaps he would."
"Why?" I said.
"I rather think he was Rebecca's cousin," she said.
I was very surprised. That man, her relation, it was not my idea of the sort of cousin Rebecca would have. Jack Favell, her cousin. "Oh," I said. "Oh, I hadn't realised that."
"He probably used to go to Mandalay a lot," said Beatrice. "I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I was very seldom there."
Her manner was abrupt. It gave me the impression she did not want to pursue the subject. "I did not take to him much," I said.
"No," said Beatrice. "I don't blame you."
I waited, but she did not say any more. I thought it wiser not to tell her how Favell had asked me to keep the visit a secret. It might lead to some complication. Besides, we were just coming to our destination, a pair of white gates and a smooth gravel drive.
"Don't forget, the old lady is nearly blind," said Beatrice, "and she's not very bright these days. I telephoned to the nurse that we were coming, so everything will be all right."
The house was large, red-bricked, and gabled. Late Victorian, I supposed. Not an attractive house. I could tell in a glance it was the sort of house that was aggressively well kept by a big staff, and all for one old lady who was nearly blind. A trim parlour-maid opened the door.
"Good afternoon, Nora. How are you?" said Beatrice.
"Very well, thank you, madam. I hope you're keeping well."
"Oh, yes, we're all flourishing. How has the old lady been, Nora?" "Rather mixed, madam. She has one good day and then a bad. She's not too bad in herself, you know. She will be pleased to see you, I'm sure."
She glanced curiously at me.
"This is Mrs. Maxim," said Beatrice.
"Yes, madam. How do you do?" said Nora. We went through a narrow hall and a drawing-room crowded with furniture to a veranda facing a square clipped lawn. There were many bright geraniums in stone vases on the steps of the veranda. In the corner was a bath-chair. Beatrice's grandmother was sitting there, propped up with pillows and surrounded by shawls. When we came close to her, I saw that she had a strong, rather uncanny resemblance to Maxim. That was what Maxim would look like if he was very old, if he was blind. The nurse by her side got up from her chair and put a mark in the book she was reading aloud. She smiled at Beatrice.
"How are you, Mrs. Lacey?" she said.
Beatrice shook hands with her and introduced me.
"The old lady looks all right," she said. "I don't know how she does it at 86. "Here we are, Gran," she said, raising her voice. "Arrived, safe and sound."
The grandmother looked in our direction.
"Dear B," she said, "how sweet of you to come and visit me. We're so dull here. Nothing for you to do."
Beatrice leant over her and kissed her.
"I brought Maxim's wife over to see you," she said. "She wanted to come and see you before, but she and Maxim have been so busy."
Beatrice prodded me in the back. "Kiss her," she murmured. I too bent down and kissed her on the cheek. The grandmother touched my face with her fingers.
"You nice thing," she said. "So good of you to come. I'm very pleased to see you, dear. You ought to have brought Maxim with you."
"Maxim is in London," I said. "He's coming back tonight."
"You might bring him next time," she said. "Sit down, dear, in this chair. where I can see you. And B, come the other side. How is dear Roger? He's a naughty boy. He doesn't come and see me.
He shall come during August, shouted Beatrice. He's leaving Eton, you know. He's going up to Oxford.
Oh, dear, he'll be quite a young man. I shan't know him.
He's taller than Giles now, said Beatrice.
She went on, telling her about Giles and Roger and the horses and the dogs. The nurse brought out some knitting and clicked her needles sharply. She turned to me, very bright, very cheerful.
How are you liking Mandalay, Mrs. De Winter?
Very much, thank you, I said.
It's a beautiful spot, isn't it? She said, the needles jabbing one another.
Of course, we don't get over there now. She's not up to it. I am sorry. I used to love our days at Mandalay.
You must come over yourself sometime, I said.
Thank you. I should love to. Mr. De Winter is well, I suppose?
Yes, very well.
You spent your honeymoon in Italy, didn't you? We were so pleased with the picture postcard Mr. De Winter sent.
I wondered whether she used we in the royal sense, or if she meant that Maxim's grandmother and herself were one. Did he send one? I can't remember.
Oh, yes, it was quite an excitement. We love anything like that. We keep a scrapbook, you know, and paste anything to do with the family inside it. Anything pleasant, that is.
How nice, I said. I caught snatches of Beatrice's conversation on the other side.
We had to put old Marksman down, she was saying. You remember old Marksman? The best hunter I ever had.
Oh, dear, not old Marksman, said her grandmother.
Yes, poor old man. Got blind in both eyes, you know.
Poor Marksman, echoed the old lady.
I thought perhaps it was not very tactful to talk about blindness, and I glanced at the nurse. She was still busy clicking her needles.
Do you hunt, Mrs. De Winter? She said.
No, I'm afraid I don't, I said.
Perhaps you will come to it. We're all very fond of hunting in this part of the world.
Yes.
Mrs. De Winter is very keen on art, said Beatrice to the nurse. I tell her there are heaps of spots in Mandalay that would make very jolly pictures.
Oh, rather, agreed the nurse, pausing a moment from the fury of knitting. What a nice hobby. I had a friend who was a wonder with her pencil. We went to Provence together one Easter, and she did such pretty sketches.
How nice, I said.
We're talking about sketching, shouted Beatrice to her grandmother. You did not know we had an artist in the family, did you?
"'Who's an artist?' said the old lady. "'I don't know any.'
"'Your new granddaughter,' said Beatrice. "'You ask her what I gave her for a wedding present.'
"'I smiled, waiting to be asked. "'The old lady turned her head in my direction.
"'What's B talking about?' she said. "'I did not know you were an artist. "'We've never had any artists in the family.'
Beatrice was joking. I said, "Of course I'm not an artist, really. I like drawing as a hobby. I've never had any lessons. Beatrice gave me some lovely books as a present."
"Oh," she said, rather bewildered. "Beatrice gave you some books, did she? Rather like taking Coles to Newcastle, wasn't it? There are so many books in the library at Mandalay."
She laughed heartily. We all joined in her joke. I hoped the subject would be left at that, but Beatrice had to harp on it.
"'You don't understand, Gran,' she said. "'They weren't ordinary books. They were volumes on art. Four of them.'
The nurse leant forward to add her tribute.
"'Mrs. Lacey is trying to explain that Mrs. De Winter is very fond of sketching as a hobby, so she gave her four fine volumes all about painting as a wedding present.'
"'What a funny thing to do,' said the grandmother. "'I don't think much of books for a wedding present. "'Nobody ever gave me any books when I was married. "'I should never have read them if they had.'
"'She laughed again. "'Beatrice looked rather offended. "'I smiled at her to show my sympathy. "'I don't think she saw. "'The nurse resumed her knitting.
"'I want my tea,' said the old lady querulously. "'Isn't it 4:30 yet? "'Why doesn't Nora bring the tea?'
"'What?' "'Hungry again after our big lunch,' said the nurse, rising to her feet and smiling brightly at her charge.
I felt rather exhausted, and wondered, rather shocked at my callous thought, why old people were sometimes such a strain. Worse than young children or puppies, because one had to be polite. I sat with my hands in my lap, ready to agree with what anybody said. The nurse was thumping the pillows and arranging the shawls. Maxim's grandmother suffered her impatience. She closed her eyes as though she too were tired. She looked more like Maxim than ever. I knew how she must have looked when she was young, tall and handsome, going round to the stables at Manderley with sugar in her pockets, holding her trailing skirt out of the mud. I pictured the nipped-in waist, the high collar. I heard her ordering the carriage for 2 o'clock. That was all finished now for her, all gone. Her husband had been dead for 40 years, her son for 15. She had to live in this bright red-gabled house with the nurse until it was time for her to die. I thought how little we know about the feelings of old people. Children, we understand, their fears and hopes and make-believe. I was a child yesterday. I had not forgotten. But Maxim's grandmother, sitting there in her shawl with her poor blind eyes, what did she feel? What was she thinking? Did she know that Beatrice was yawning and glancing at her watch? Did she guess that we had come to visit her because we felt it right? It was a duty, so that when she got home afterwards, Beatrice would be able to say, "Well, that clears my conscience for 3 months." Did she ever think about Manderley? Did she remember sitting at the dining-room table where I sat? Did she too have tea under the chestnut tree? Or was it all forgotten and laid aside, and was there nothing left behind that calm, pale face of hers, but little aches and little strange discomforts, a blurred thankfulness when the sun shone, a tremor when the wind blew cold? I wished that I could lay my hands upon her face and take the years away. I wished I could see her young, as she was once, with colour in her cheeks and chestnut hair, alert and active as Beatrice by her side, talking as she did about hunting hounds and horses, not sitting there with her eyes closed while the nurse thumped the pillows behind her head. "We've got a treat today, you know," said the nurse. "Watercress sandwiches for tea. We love watercress, don't we?"
"Is it watercress day?" said Maxim's grandmother, raising her head from the pillows and looking towards the door. "You did not tell me that. Why does not Nora bring in the tea?"
"I wouldn't have your job, sister, for 1,000 a day," said Beatrice, sotto voce, to the nurse. "Oh, I'm used to it, Mrs. Lacey," smiled the nurse. "It's very comfortable here, you know. Of course we have our bad days, but they might be a great deal worse. She's very easy, not like some patients. The staff are obliging, too. That's really the main thing." "Here comes Nora."
The parlour-maid brought out a little gate-leg table and a snowy cloth.
"What a time you've been, Nora," grumbled the old lady.
"It's only just turned the half-hour, madam," said Nora in a special voice, bright and cheerful like the nurse.
I wondered if Maxim's grandmother realised that people spoke to her in this way. I wondered when they had done so for the first time, and if she had noticed then. Perhaps she had said to herself, "They think I'm getting old. How very ridiculous." And then, little by little, she had become accustomed to it. And now it was as though they had always done so. It was part of her background. But the young woman with the chestnut hair and the narrow waist who gave sugar to the horses, where was she? We drew our chairs to the gate-leg table and began to eat the watercress sandwiches. The nurse prepared special ones for the old lady.
"There now, isn't that a treat?" she said.
I saw a slow smile pass over the calm, placid face.
"I like watercress day," she said.
The tea was scalding, much too hot to drink. The nurse drank hers in tiny sips.
"Boiling water today," she said, nodding at Beatrice. "I have such trouble about it. They will let the tea stew. I've told them time and time again about it. They will not listen." "Oh, they're all the same," said Beatrice. "I've given it up as a bad job."
The old lady stirred hers with a spoon, her eyes very far and distant. I wished I knew what she was thinking about.
"Did you have fine weather in Italy?"
said the nurse.
"Yes, it was very warm," I said.
Beatrice turned to her grandmother.
"They had lovely weather in Italy for their honeymoon," she says. "Maxim got quite sunburned."
"Why isn't Maxim here today?" said the old lady.
"We told you, darling. Maxim had to go to London," said Beatrice impatiently. "Some dinner, you know. Giles went, too."
"Oh, I see. Why did you say Maxim was in Italy?"
"He was in Italy, Gran. In April. They're back at Manderley now."
She glanced at the nurse, shrugging her shoulders.
"Mr. and Mrs. de Winter are in Manderley now," repeated the nurse.
"It's been lovely there this month," I said, drawing nearer to Maxim's grandmother.
The roses are in bloom now. I wish I had brought you some. Yes, I like roses, she said vaguely, and then peering closer at me with her dim blue eyes. Are you staying at Manderley too?
I swallowed. There was a slight pause. Then Beatrice broke in with her loud, impatient voice.
Gran, darling, you know perfectly well she lives there now. She and Maxim are married.
I noticed the nurse put down her cup of tea and glanced swiftly at the old lady. She had relaxed against the pillows, plucking at her shawl, and her mouth began to tremble.
You talk too much, all of you. I don't understand.
Then she looked across at me, a frown on her face, and began shaking her head.
Who are you, my dear? I haven't seen you before. I don't know your face. I don't remember you at Manderley. B, who is this child? Why did not Maxim bring Rebecca? I'm so fond of Rebecca. Where is dear Rebecca?
There was a long pause, a moment of agony. I felt my cheeks grow scarlet. The nurse got to her feet very quickly and went to the bath chair.
I want Rebecca, repeated the old lady. What have you done with Rebecca?
Beatrice rose clumsily from the table, shaking the cups and saucers. She too had turned very red and her mouth twitched.
I think you better go, Mrs. Lacey, said the nurse, rather pink and flustered. She's looking a little tired, and when she wanders like this, it sometimes lasts for hours. She does get excited like this from time to time. It's very unfortunate it should happen today. I'm sure you will understand, Mrs. De Winter.
She turned apologetically to me. Of course, I said quickly. It's much better we should go. Beatrice and I groped for our bags and gloves. The nurse had turned to her patient again.
Now, what's all this about? Do you want your nice watercress sandwich that I've got for you?
Where is Rebecca? Why did not Maxim come and bring Rebecca?
Replied the thin, querulous voice. We went through the drawing-room to the hall and let ourselves out of the front door. Beatrice started up the car without a word. We drove down the smooth gravel drive and out of the white gates. I stared straight in front of me down the road. I did not mind for myself. I should not have cared if I had been alone. I minded for Beatrice. The whole thing had been so wretched and awkward for Beatrice. She spoke to me when we turned out of the village.
My dear, she began, I'm so dreadfully sorry. I don't know what to say.
Don't be absurd, Beatrice, I said hurriedly. It doesn't matter a bit. It's absolutely all right.
I had no idea she would do that, said Beatrice. I would never have dreamt of taking you to see her. I'm so frightfully sorry.
There's nothing to be sorry about. Please don't say any more. I can't make it out. She knew all about you. I wrote and told her, and so did Maxim. She was so interested in the wedding abroad. You forget how old she is, I said. Why should she remember that? She doesn't connect me with Maxim. She only connects him with Rebecca. We went on driving in silence. It was a relief to be in the car again. I did not mind the jerky motion and the swaying corners.
I'd forgotten she was so fond of Rebecca, said Beatrice slowly. I was a fool not to expect something like this. I don't believe she ever took it in properly about the accident. Oh, Lord, what a ghastly afternoon! What on earth will you think of me?
Please, Beatrice, don't. I tell you, I don't mind.
Rebecca made a great fuss of her always, and she used to have the old lady over to Manderley. Poor darling Gran was much more alert then. She used to rock with laughter whatever Rebecca said. Of course, she was always very amusing, and the old lady loved that. She had an amazing gift, Rebecca, I mean, of being attractive to people. Men, women, children, dogs. I suppose the old lady has never forgotten her. My dear, you won't thank me for this afternoon.
I don't mind. I don't mind, I repeated mechanically. If only Beatrice could leave the subject alone, it did not interest me. What did it matter after all? What did anything matter?
Giles will be very upset, said Beatrice. He will blame me for taking you over. What an idiotic thing to do, Bea, I can hear him saying it. I shall get into a fine row.
Don't say anything about it, I said. I would much rather it was forgotten. The story will only get repeated and exaggerated.
Giles will know something is wrong from my face. I've never been able to hide anything from him.
I was silent. I knew how the story would be tossed about in their immediate circle of friends. I could imagine the little crowd at Sunday lunch, the round eyes, the eager ears, and the gasps and exclamations. My Lord, how awful! What on earth did you do? And then, how did she take it? How terribly embarrassing for everyone! The The only thing that mattered to me was that Maxim should never come to hear of it. One day I might tell Frank Crawley, but not yet. Not for quite a while. It was not long before we came to the high road at the top of the hill. In the distance, I could see the first grey roofs of Kerith, while to the right, in a hollow, lay the deep woods of Manderley and the sea beyond. "Are you in a frightful hurry to get home?" said Beatrice. "No," I said. "I don't think so. Why?"
"Would you think me a perfect pig if I dropped you at the lodge gates? If I drive like hell now, I shall just be in time to meet Giles by the London train, and it will save him taking the station taxi."
"Of course," I said. "I can walk down the drive."
"Thanks awfully," she said gratefully.
I felt the afternoon had been too much for her. She wanted to be alone again, and did not want to face another belated tea at Manderley. I got out of the car at the lodge gates, and we kissed goodbye.
"Put on some weight next time I see you," she said. "It doesn't suit you to be so thin. Give Maxim my love, and forgive me for today."
She vanished in a cloud of dust, and I turned in down the drive. I wondered if it had altered much since Maxim's grandmother had driven down it in her carriage. She had ridden here as a young woman. She had smiled at the woman at the lodge as I did now, and in her day the lodgekeeper's wife had curtsied, sweeping the path with her full wide skirt. This woman nodded to me briefly, and then called to her little boy, who was grubbing with some kittens at the back. Maxim's grandmother had bowed her head to avoid the sweeping branches of the trees, and the horse had trotted down the twisting drive where I now walked. The drive had been wider then, and smoother too, better kept. The woods did not encroach upon it. I did not think of her as she was now, lying against those pillows with that shawl around her. I saw her when she was young, and when Manderley was her home. I saw her wandering in the gardens with a small boy, Maxim's father, clattering behind her on his hobby horse. He would wear a stiff Norfolk jacket and a round white collar. Picnics to the cove would be an expedition, a treat that was not indulged in very often. There would be a photograph somewhere in an old album, all the family sitting very straight and rigid round a tablecloth set upon the beach, the servants in the background beside a huge lunch basket. And I saw Maxim's grandmother when she was older too, a few years ago, walking on the terrace at Manderley, leaning on a stick. And someone walked beside her, laughing, holding her arm. Someone tall and slim and very beautiful, who had a gift, Beatrice said, of being attractive to people. Easy to like, I supposed. Easy to love. When I came to the end of the long drive at last, I saw that Maxim's car was standing in front of the house. My heart lifted. I ran quickly into the hall. His hat and gloves were lying on the table. I went towards the library, and as I came near, I heard the sound of voices, one raised louder than the other. Maxim's voice. The door was shut. I hesitated a moment before going in.
"You can write and tell him from me to keep away from Manderley in future, do you hear? Never mind who told me. That's of no importance. I happen to know his car was seen here yesterday afternoon. If you want to meet him, you can meet him outside Manderley. I won't have him inside the gates, do you understand? Remember, I'm warning you for the last time."
I slipped away from the door to the stairs. I heard the door of the library open. I ran swiftly up the stairs and hid in the gallery. Mrs. Danvers came out of the library, shutting the door behind her. I crouched against the wall of the gallery so that I should not be seen. I had caught one glimpse of her face. It was grey with anger, distorted, horrible. She passed up the stairs swiftly and silently, and disappeared through the door leading to the west wing. I waited a moment. Then I went slowly downstairs to the library. I opened the door and went in. Maxim was standing by the window, some letters in his hand. His back was turned to me. For a moment I thought of creeping out again and going upstairs to my room and sitting there. He must have heard me, though, for he swung round impatiently.
"Who is it now?" he said.
I smiled, holding out my hands. "Hello," I said.
"Oh, it's you."
I could tell in a glance that something had made him very angry. His mouth was hard, his nostrils white and pinched.
"What have you been doing with yourself?" he said.
He kissed the top of my head and put his arm round my shoulder. I felt as if a very long time had passed since he had left me yesterday. "I've been to see your grandmother," I said. "Beatrice drove me over this afternoon."
"How was the old lady?"
"All right."
"What's happened to Bea?"
"She had to get back to meet Giles." We sat down together on the window seat. I took his hand in mine. "I hated you being away. I've missed you terribly," I said.
"Have you?"
he said. We did not say anything for a bit. I just held his hand. "Was it hot up in London?" I said.
"Yes, pretty awful. I always hate the place."
I wondered if he would tell me what had happened just now in the library with Mrs. Danvers. I wondered who had told him about Favell. "Are you worried about something?" I said.
"I've had a long day," he said. "That drive twice in 24 hours is too much for anyone."
He got up and wandered away, lighting a cigarette. I knew then that he was not going to tell me about Mrs. Danvers. "I'm tired, too," I said slowly. "It's been a funny sort of day."
Chapter 16. It was one Sunday, I remember, when we had an invasion of visitors during the afternoon, that the subject of the fancy dress ball was first brought up. Frank Crawley had come over to lunch, and we were all three of us looking forward to a peaceful afternoon under the chestnut tree, when we heard the fatal sound of a car rounding the sweep in the drive. It was too late to warn Frith. The car itself came upon us standing on the terrace with cushions and papers under our arms. We had to come forward and welcome the unexpected guests. As often happens in such cases, these were not to be the only visitors. Another car arrived about half an hour afterwards, followed by three local people who had walked from Kerith, and we found ourselves with the peace stripped from our day, entertaining group after group of dreary acquaintances, doing the regulation walk in the grounds, the tour of the rose garden, the stroll across the lawns, and the formal inspection of the Happy Valley. They stayed for tea, of course, and instead of a lazy nibbling of cucumber sandwiches under the chestnut tree, we had the paraphernalia of a stiff tea in the drawing-room, which I always loathed. Frith in his element, of course, directing Robert with a lift of his eyebrows, and myself rather hot and flustered with a monstrous silver teapot and kettle that I never knew how to manage. I found it very difficult to gauge the exact moment when it became imperative to dilute the tea with the boiling water, and more difficult still to concentrate on the small talk that was going on at my side. Frank Crawley was invaluable at a moment like this. He took the cups from me and handed them to people, and when my answers seemed more than usually vague, owing to my concentration on the silver teapot, he quietly and unobtrusively put in his small wedge to the conversation, relieving me of responsibility. Maxim was always at the other end of the room, showing a book to a bore or pointing out a picture, playing the perfect host in his own inimitable way, and the business of tea was a side issue that did not matter to him. His own cup of tea grew cold, left on a side table behind some flowers, and I, steaming behind my kettle, and Frank, gallantly juggling with scones and angel cake, were left to minister to the common wants of the herd. It was Lady Crowan, a tiresome, gushing woman who lived in Kerith, who introduced the matter. There was one of those pauses in conversation that happen in every tea party, and I saw Frank's lips about to form the inevitable and idiotic remark about an angel passing overhead, when Lady Crowan, balancing a piece of cake on the edge of her saucer, looked up at Maxim, who happened to be beside her. "Oh, Mr. de Winter," she said, "there is something I've been wanting to ask you for ages. Now tell me, is there any chance of you reviving the Manderley fancy-dress ball?" She put her head on one side as she spoke, flashing her two prominent teeth in what she supposed was a smile. I lowered my head instantly and became very busy with the emptying of my own teacup, screening myself behind the cosy. It was a moment or two before Maxim replied, and when he did, his voice was quite calm and matter-of-fact.
"I haven't thought about it," he said, "and I don't think anyone else has."
"Oh, but I assure you we have all thought of it so much," continued Lady Crowan. "It used to make the summer for all of us in this part of the world. You have no idea of the pleasure it used to give. Can't I persuade you to think about it again?"
"Well, I don't know," said Maxim dryly. "It was all rather a business to organize. You had better ask Frank Crawley. He'd have to do it."
"Oh, Mr. Crawley, do be on my side," she persisted, and one or two of the others joined in. "It would be a most popular move, you know. We all miss the Manderley gaiety."
I heard Frank's quiet voice beside me.
"I don't mind organizing the ball if Maxim has no objection to giving it. It's up to him and Mrs. de Winter. It's nothing to do with me."
Of course, I was bombarded at once. Lady Crowan moved her chair so that the cosy no longer hid me from view.
"Now, Mrs. de Winter, you get round your husband. You are the person he will listen to. He should give the ball in your honour as the bride."
"Yes, of course," said somebody else, a man. "We missed the fun of the wedding, you know. It's a shame to deprive us of all excitement. Hands up for the Manderley fancy dress ball. There, you see, de Winter, carried unanimously."
There was much laughter and clapping of hands. Maxim lit a cigarette and his eyes met mine over the teapot.
"What do you think about it?" he said.
"I don't know," I said uncertainly. I don't mind."
"Of course she longs to have a ball in her honour," gushed Lady Crowan. "What girl wouldn't? You'd look sweet, Mrs. de Winter, dressed as a little Dresden shepherdess, your hair tucked under a big three-cornered hat."
I thought of my clumsy hands and feet and the slope of my shoulders. A fine Dresden shepherdess I should make. What an idiot the woman was. I was not surprised when nobody agreed with her, and once more I was grateful to Frank for turning the conversation away from me. "As a matter of fact, Maxim, one was talking about it the other day. I suppose we shall be having some sort of celebration for the bride, shan't we, Mr. Crawley?" he said. "I wish Mr. de Winter would give a ball again. It was rare fun for all of us. It was Tucker at the Home Farm," he added to Lady Crowan. "Of course they do adore a show of any kind. I don't know," I told him. "Mr. de Winter hasn't said anything to me."
"There you are," said Lady Crowan triumphantly to the drawing-room in general. "What did I say? Your own people are asking for a ball. If you don't care for us, surely you care about them."
Maxim still watched me doubtfully over the teapot. It occurred to me that perhaps he thought I could not face it, that being shy, as he knew only too well, I should find myself unable to cope. I did not want him to think that. I did not want him to feel I should let him down. "I think it would be rather fun," I said. Maxim turned away, shrugging his shoulders.
"That settles it, of course," he said. "All right, Frank, you will have to go ahead with the arrangements. Better get Mrs. Danvers to help you. She will remember the form."
"That amazing Mrs. Danvers is still with you, then," said Lady Crowan.
"Yes," said Maxim shortly. "Have some more cake, will you, or have you finished? Then let's all go into the garden."
We wandered out onto the terrace, everyone discussing the prospect of the ball and suitable dates, and then, greatly to my relief, the car parties decided it was time to take their departure, and the walkers went too, on being offered a lift. I went back into the drawing-room and had another cup of tea, which I thoroughly enjoyed, now that the burden of entertaining had been taken from me. And Frank came too, and we crumbled up the remains of the scones and ate them, feeling like conspirators. Maxim was throwing sticks for Jasper on the lawn. I wondered if it was the same in every home, this feeling of exuberance when visitors had gone. We did not say anything about the ball for a little while, and then, when I had finished my cup of tea and wiped my sticky fingers on a handkerchief, I said to Frank, "What do you truthfully think about this fancy dress business?" Frank hesitated, half glancing out of the window at Maxim on the lawn. "I don't know," he said. Maxim did not seem to object, did he? I thought he took the suggestion very well. "It was difficult for him to do anything else," I said. "What a tiresome person Lady Crowan is. Do you really believe all the people round here are talking and dreaming of nothing but a fancy dress ball at Manderley?"
"I think they would all enjoy a show of some sort," said Frank. "We're very conventional down here, you know, about these things."
I don't honestly think Lady Crowan was exaggerating when she said something should be done in your honour. After all, Mrs. de Winter, you are a bride. How pompous and stupid it sounded. I wished Frank would not always be so terribly correct. "I'm not a bride," I said. "I did not even have a proper wedding. No white dress or orange blossom or trailing bridesmaids. I don't want any silly dance given in my honour."
"It's a very fine sight, Manderley en fête," said Frank. "You'll enjoy it, you see. You won't have to do anything alarming. You just receive the guests, and there's nothing in that. Perhaps you'll give me a dance."
Dear Frank, I loved his little solemn air of gallantry. "You shall have as many dances as you like," I said. "I shan't dance with anyone except you and Maxim."
"Oh, but that would not look right at all," said Frank seriously. "People would be very offended. You must dance with the people who ask you."
I turned away to hide my smile. It was a joy to me the way he never knew when his leg had been pulled. "Do you think Lady Crone's suggestion about the Dresden shepherdess was a good one?" I said slyly. He considered me, solemnly, without the trace of a smile.
"Yes, I do," he said. "I think you'd look very well indeed."
I burst into laughter. "Oh, Frank, dear, I do love you," I said, and he turned rather pink, a little shocked, I think, at my impulsive words, and a little hurt, too, that I was laughing at him.
"I don't see that I've said anything funny," he said stiffly.
Maxim came in at the window, Jasper dancing at his heels.
"What's all the excitement about?" he said.
"Frank is being so gallant," I said. "He thinks Lady Crone's idea of my dressing up as a Dresden shepherdess is nothing to laugh at."
"Lady Crone is a damned nuisance," said Maxim. "If she had to write out all the invitations and organize the affair, she would not be so enthusiastic. It's always been the same, though. The locals look upon Manderley as if it was a pavilion on the end of a pier, and expect us to put up a turn for their benefit. I suppose we shall have to ask the whole county."
"I've got the records in the office," said Frank. "It won't really entail much work. Licking the stamps is the longest job."
"We'll give that to you to do," said Maxim, smiling at me. "Oh, we'll do that in the office," said Frank. "Mrs. De Winter need not bother her head about anything at all."
I wondered what they would say if I suddenly announced my intention of running the whole affair. Laugh, I supposed, and then begin talking of something else. I was glad, of course, to be relieved of responsibility, but it rather added to my sense of humility to feel that I was not even capable of licking stamps. I thought of the writing desk in the morning room, the docketed pigeonholes, all marked in ink, by that slanting, pointed hand. "What will you wear?" I said to Maxim.
"I never dress up," said Maxim. "It's the one perquisite allowed to the host, isn't it, Frank?"
"I can't really go as a Dresden shepherdess," I said. "What on earth shall I do? I'm not much good at dressing up."
"Put a ribbon round your hair and be Alice in Wonderland," said Maxim lightly. "You look like it now, with your finger in your mouth."
"Don't be so rude," I said. "I know my hair is straight, but it isn't as straight as that. I tell you what, I'll give you and Frank the surprise of your lives, and you won't know me."
"As long as you don't black your face and pretend to be a monkey, I don't mind what you do," said Maxim.
"All right, that's a bargain," I said. "I'll keep my costume a secret to the last minute, and you won't know anything about it. Come on, Jasper, we don't care what they say, do we?" I heard Maxim laughing as I went out into the garden, and he said something to Frank, which I did not catch. I wished he would not always treat me as a child, rather spoilt, rather irresponsible, someone to be petted from time to time when the mood came upon him, but more often forgotten, more often patted on the shoulder and told to run away and play. I wished something would happen to make me look wiser, more mature. Was it always going to be like this? He, away ahead of me, with his own moods that I did not share, his secret troubles that I did not know, would we never be together, he a man and I a woman, standing shoulder to shoulder, hand in hand, with no gulf between us? I did not want to be a child. I wanted to be his wife, his mother. I wanted to be old. I stood on the terrace, biting my nails, looking down towards the sea, and as I stood there, I wondered for the 20th time that day whether it was by Maxim's orders that those rooms in the West Wing were kept furnished and untouched. I wondered if he went, as Mrs. Danvers did, and touched the brushes on the dressing table, opened the wardrobe doors, and put his hands amongst the clothes. "Come on, Jasper," I shouted. "Run, run with me, come on, can't you?" And I tore across the grass, savagely, angrily, the bitter tears behind my eyes, with Jasper leaping at my heels and barking hysterically. The news soon spread about the fancy dress ball. My little maid Clarice, her eyes shining with excitement, talked of nothing else. I gathered from her that the servants in general were delighted. "Mr. Frith says it will be like old times," said Clarice eagerly. "I heard him saying so to Alice in the passage this morning. What will you wear, madam?" "I don't know, Clarice. I can't think," I said. "Mother said I was to be sure and tell her," said Clarice. "She remembers the last ball they gave at Manderley, and she has never forgotten it. Will you be hiring a costume from London, do you think?" "I haven't made up my mind, Clarice," I said. "But I tell you what, when I do decide, I shall tell you and nobody else. It will be a dead secret between us both." "Oh, madam, how exciting," breathed Clarice. "I don't know how I'm going to wait for the day." I was curious to know Mrs. Danvers' reaction to the news. Since that afternoon, I dreaded even the sound of her voice down the house telephone, and by using Robert as mediator between us, I was spared this last ordeal. I could not forget the expression of her face when she left the library after that interview with Maxim. I thanked God she had not seen me crouching in the gallery, and I wondered, too, if she thought that it was I who had told Maxim about Favell's visit to the house. If so, she would hate me more than ever. I shuddered now when I remembered the touch of her hand on my arm, and that dreadful soft, intimate pitch of her voice close to my ear. I did not want to remember anything about that afternoon. That was why I did not speak to her, not even on the house telephone. The preparations went on for the ball. Everything seemed to be done down at the estate office. Maxim and Frank were down there every morning. As Frank had said, I did not have to bother my head about anything. I don't think I licked one stamp. I began to get in a panic about my costume. It seemed so feeble not to be able to think of anything, and I kept remembering all the people who would come from Kerith and round about, the bishop's wife who had enjoyed herself so much the last time, Beatrice and Giles, that tiresome Lady Crowan, and many more people I did not know and who had never seen me. They would every one of them have some criticism to offer, some curiosity to know what sort of effort I should make. At last, in desperation, I remembered the books that Beatrice had given me for a wedding present, and I sat down in the library one morning, turning over the pages as a last hope, passing from illustration to illustration in a sort of frenzy. Nothing seemed suitable. They were all so elaborate and pretentious. Those gorgeous costumes of velvet and silk in the reproductions given of Rubens, Rembrandt, and others. I got hold of a piece of paper and a pencil, and copied one or two of them, but they did not please me, and I threw the sketches into the waste-paper basket in disgust, thinking no more about them. In the evening, when I was changing for dinner, there was a knock at my bedroom door. I called, "Come in," thinking it was Clarice. The door opened, and it was not Clarice. It was Mrs. Danvers. She held a piece of paper in her hand. "I hope you will forgive me disturbing you," she said. "But I was not sure whether you meant to throw these drawings away. All the waste-paper baskets are always brought to me to check at the end of the day, in case of mislaying anything of value. Robert told me this was thrown into the library basket." I had turned quite cold all over at the sight of her, and at first I could not find my voice. She held out the paper for me to see. It was the rough drawing I had done during the morning. "No, Mrs. Danvers," I said after a moment, "it doesn't matter throwing that away. It was only a rough sketch. I don't want it." "Very good," she said. "I thought it better to inquire from you personally to save any misunderstanding." "Yes," I said. "Yes, of course." I thought she would turn and go, but she went on standing there by the door. "So you have not decided yet what you will wear," she said. There was a hint of derision in her voice, a trace of odd satisfaction. I supposed she had heard of my efforts through Clarice in some way. "No," I said. "No, I haven't decided." She continued watching me, her hand on the handle of the door. "I wonder you don't copy one of the pictures in the gallery," she said.
I pretended to file my nails. They were too short and too brittle, but the action gave me something to do, and I did not have to look at her. "Yes, I might think about that," I said. I wondered privately why such an idea had never come to me before. It was an obvious and very good solution to my difficulty. I did not want her to know this, though. I went on filing my nails. "All the pictures in the gallery would make good costumes," said Mrs. Danvers, "especially that one of the young lady in white, with her hat in her hand. I wonder Mr. de Winter does not make it a period ball, everyone dressed more or less the same, to be in keeping. I never think it looks right to see a clown dancing with a lady in powder and patches." "Some people enjoy the variety," I said. "They think it makes it all the more amusing." "I don't like it myself," said Mrs. Danvers. Her voice was surprisingly normal and friendly, and I wondered why it was she had taken the trouble to come up with my discarded sketch herself. Did she want to be friends with me at last? Or did she realize that it had not been me at all who had told Maxim about Favelle, and this was her way of thanking me for my silence? "Has not Mr. de Winter suggested a costume for you?" she said. "No," I said, after a moment's hesitation. "No, I want to surprise him and Mr. Crawley. I don't want them to know anything about it." "It's not for me to make a suggestion, I know," she said. "But when you do decide, I should advise you to have your dress made in London. There is no one down here can do that sort of thing well. Votre in Bond Street is a good place, I know." "I must remember that," I said. "Yes," she said. And then, as she opened the door, "I should study the pictures in the gallery, madam, if I were you, especially the one I mentioned. And you need not think I will give you away. I won't say a word to anyone." "Thank you, Mrs. Danvers," I said. She shut the door very gently behind her. I went on with my dressing, puzzled at her attitude, so different from our last encounter, and wondering whether I had the unpleasant Favelle to thank for it. Rebecca's cousin. Why should Maxim dislike Rebecca's cousin? Why had he forbidden him to come to Manderley? Beatrice had called him a bounder. She had not said much about him, and the more I considered him, the more I agreed with her. Those hot blue eyes, that loose mouth, and the careless, familiar laugh. Some people would consider him attractive. Girls in sweet shops giggling behind the counter, and girls who gave one programs in a cinema. I knew how he would look at them, smiling and half-whistling a tune under his breath, the sort of look and the type of whistle that would make one feel uncomfortable. I wondered how well he knew Manderley. He seemed quite at home, and Jasper certainly recognized him, but these two facts did not fit in with Maxim's words to Mrs. Danvers, and I could not connect him with my idea of Rebecca. Rebecca was her beauty, her charm, her breeding. Why did she have a cousin like Jack Favelle? It was wrong, out of all proportion. I decided he must be the skeleton in the family cupboard, and Rebecca, with her generosity, had taken pity on him from time to time and invited him to Manderley, perhaps when Maxim was from home, knowing his dislike. There had been some argument about it, probably, Rebecca defending him, and ever after this, perhaps a slight awkwardness whenever his name was mentioned. As I sat down to dinner in the dining-room in my accustomed place, with Maxim at the head of the table, I pictured Rebecca sitting in where I sat now, picking up her fork for the fish, and then the telephone ringing and Frith coming into the room and saying, "Mr. Favelle on the phone, madam, wishing to speak to you." And Rebecca would get up from her chair with a quick glance at Maxim, who would not say anything, who would go on eating his fish. And when she came back, having finished her conversation and sat down in her place again, Rebecca would begin talking about something different, in a gay, careless way, to cover up the little cloud between them. At first, Maxim would be glum, answering in monosyllables, but little by little she would win his humour back again, telling him some story of her day, about someone she had seen in Kerith, and when they had finished the next course, he would be laughing again, looking at her and smiling, putting out his hand to her across the table. "What the devil are you thinking about?" said Maxim. I started, the colour flooding my face, for in that brief moment,
60 seconds in time, perhaps, I had so identified myself with Rebecca that my own dull self did not exist, had never come to Manderley. I had gone back in thought and in person to the days that were gone. "Do you know you were going through the most extraordinary antics instead of eating your fish?" said Maxim. "First you listened, as though you heard the telephone, and then your lips moved, and you threw half a glance at me, and you shook your head and smiled and shrugged your shoulders. All in about a second. Are you practicing your appearance for the fancy dress ball?" He looked across at me, laughing, and I wondered what he would say if he really knew my thoughts, my heart, and my mind. And for that one second, he had been the Maxim of another year, and I had been Rebecca. "You look like a little criminal," he said. "What is it?" "Nothing," I said quickly. "I wasn't doing anything. Tell me, what were you thinking?" "Why should I? You never tell me what you're thinking about."
"I don't think you've ever asked me, have you?"
"Yes, I did, once."
"I don't remember."
"We were in the library."
"Very probably. What did I say?"
"You told me you were wondering who had been chosen to play for Surrey against Middlesex."
Maxim laughed again. "What a disappointment to you. What did you hope I was thinking?"
"Something very different."
"What sort of thing?"
"Oh, I don't know."
"No, I don't suppose you do. If I told you I was thinking about Surrey and Middlesex, I was thinking about Surrey and Middlesex. Men are simpler than you imagine, my sweet child. But what goes on in the twisted, tortuous minds of women would baffle anyone. Do you know, you did not look a bit like yourself just now. You had quite a different expression on your face."
"I did? What sort of expression?"
"I don't know that I can explain. You looked older suddenly, deceitful. It was rather unpleasant."
"I did not mean to."
"No, I don't suppose you did."
I drank some water, watching him over the rim of my glass. "Don't you want me to look older?" I said.
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because it would not suit you."
"One day I shall. It can't be helped. I shall have grey hair and lines and things."
"I don't mind that."
"What do you mind, then?"
"I don't want you to look like you did just now. You had a twist to your mouth and a flash of knowledge in your eyes. Not the right sort of knowledge."
I felt very curious, rather excited. "What do you mean, Maxim? What isn't the right sort of knowledge?" He did not answer for a moment. Frith had come back into the room and was changing the plates. Maxim waited until Frith had gone behind the screen and through the service door before speaking again.
"When I met you first, you had a certain expression on your face," he said slowly, "and you have it still. I am not going to define it, I don't know how to, but it was one of the reasons why I married you. A moment ago, when you were going through that curious little performance, the expression had gone. Something else had taken its place."
"What sort of thing? Explain to me, Maxim," I said eagerly. He considered me a moment, his eyebrows raised, whistling softly.
"Listen, my sweet. When you were a little girl, were you ever forbidden to read certain books? And did your father put those books under lock and key?"
"Yes," I said.
"Well, then, a husband is not so very different from a father after all. There is a certain type of knowledge I prefer you not to have. It's better kept under lock and key. So that's that. And now eat up your peaches and don't ask me any more questions, or I shall put you in the corner."
"I wish you would not treat me as if I was six," I said.
"How do you want to be treated?"
"Like other men treat their wives."
"Knock you about, you mean?"
"Don't be absurd. Why must you make a joke of everything?"
"I'm not joking. I'm very serious."
"No, you're not. I can tell by your eyes. You're playing with me all the time, just as if I was a silly little girl."
"Alice in Wonderland, that was a good idea of mine. Have you bought your sash and your hair ribbon yet?"
"I warn you, you'll get the surprise of your life when you do see me in my fancy dress."
"I'm sure I shall. Get on with your peach and don't talk with your mouth full. I've got a lot of letters to write after dinner."
He did not wait for me to finish. He got up and strolled about the room and asked Frith to bring the coffee in the library. I sat still, sullenly, being as slow as I could, hoping to keep things back and irritate him. But Frith took no notice of me and my peach. He brought the coffee at once, and Maxim went off to the library by himself. When I had finished, I went upstairs to the minstrel's gallery to have a look at the pictures. I knew them well, of course, by now, but had never studied them with a view to reproducing one of them as a fancy dress. Mrs. Danvers was right, of course.